From the Lynn to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 9th day of April, 2026. It's USDA Report Day. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about this morning's release from the United States Department of Agriculture of the World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates. We'll do that with Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net, and then we'll turn our attention, as we close out our time together, to Mike Tenor at T-Storm Weather to take a look at the forecast across the Midwest, particularly into the Great Plains states, Oklahoma, Texas, and Kansas, the hard red winter wheat growing regions. And along the way, we'll discuss chemistry for this season on the farm in the Midwest, corn and soybeans, and water hemp resistance. Aaron Hager has some thoughts on what producers might try, all on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn for the day settled at $4.44, 3 1/4 lower. July at $4.55, down 3. And December futures, 1 3/4 lower at $4.74 1/4. May beans, $11.65 1/4, up 3 1/4. July, $11.81, 3 higher. And November soybeans, 1/2 higher at $11.52 1/2. Bean meal, $3.50 higher. The bean oil, 28 cents higher. Wheat futures in the soft red, July harvest month at $5.85 a bushel, down 6 1/4, and the hard red July at $6.05 3/4, down 6 1/4 cents. Live cattle futures up $1.27 1/2, feeders $2.42 1/2 higher, and lean hogs down 52 1/2 cents. Crude oil, $3.40 lower at $97.74 a barrel. That's in the WTI or West Texas, and gasoline as a penny and a tenth higher for the day. Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net now joins us to discuss this morning's USDA World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates report, along with how the trade handled it. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being with us. There weren't really any changes to speak of in the report. What'd you think of it?
Yeah, it was pretty blasé, pretty typical April report. I mean, you know, most of the time, April doesn't really amount to much. Everybody's looking forward to May when we get the new supply and demand estimates for new crops. So, yeah, just really wasn't anything in that report to kind of hang your hat on. I think some people were kind of hoping, based upon quarterly stocks, that maybe they would have lowered corn carry a little bit. If you kind of back into some of those numbers, you could make that case, but that's not what they gave us. And so I think that was viewed as maybe a little bearish, considering maybe the trade was expecting a little tighter number. But yeah, no changes at all today.
In the world numbers, were there changes that you paid attention to?
Nothing major, but you know, world stocks a little more. I believe they added about 1 million tons, nothing too extravagant. But in essence, I think what it does, it just kind of highlights the fact that we're not running out of corn anytime soon. And so, you know, I think that's kind of how the trade's looking at it, is that we've got an ample supply. You know, and for the time being, until we have a reason to believe otherwise, there's no sense in getting too worried about, you know, what the situation is. They know demand's good, but they also know that we've got ample supply.
What are you telling producers as they get ready to go to the field?
Well, you know, as far as the cash is concerned, I mean, this is a time of year when sometimes you can get a nice little push. And so you kind of want to pay attention to that. There's no question that whenever growers go to the field, typically, of course, manpower is a little bit limited. It's hard to move bushels. So if there's a chance for a basis push and someone's got an opportunity maybe to step in and sell a little corn at a little better price than what they, you know, have seen here lately, then there's no doubt that it's something to pay attention to. As far as new crop goes, I mean, I'm not super excited about it yet, but if people haven't done anything, you know, in this 470, 475 area, you know, I would challenge them to consider what would they have said about 475, you know, back in January. And so you got to understand, whenever we get a little higher prices, typically we tend to get bullish, and I just think that that's not the right way to look at it. I want to look at locking in some worst case scenarios just in case this thing goes on south.
Next week on the 14th, USDA's counterpart in Brazil, CONAB, will update its, I believe, 5th look at the size of that crop. Do you expect them to show anything different for corn or soybeans there?
You know, I think there's a growing thought that this corn crop could get just a little bit bigger for Safrina, especially than the USDA. As far as the bean crop, I think everyone knows it's been a pretty good size crop. Of course, they had some harvest issues, but overall, you know, it's just a big crop. And so I really don't expect they're going to see anything major. I do think that there's one disparity, you know, that we continue to see, and that is that this Argentine crop looks like it's bigger than what the USDA is suggesting. So, you know, that might be a place where you could see some production adjustments on down the road as long as that Argentine crop finishes well.
Have you and the JSA folks talked very much about what China and Brazil have been doing as it's related to trade? There have been some hiccups. While Brazil is exporting a phenomenal amount of soybeans to China, there have been some times where they have stopped those loads or rejected them. Does that make much of a difference to the world?
Yeah, I think it makes a bit of a difference in the short run. I think overall, you know, the understanding is there that that the beans are there, and that certainly it's going to be tough for U.S. soybeans, as far as exports are concerned, to probably hit that mark. I mean, I just don't see it happening. You know, when you look at shipments, for instance, we're running, I believe, around 25 to 30% behind a year ago. USDA's, I think, suggesting maybe 15% behind a year ago. So you've got to assume that with Brazil having the available supply they do, while you may have a hiccup here and there, they're still significantly cheaper. So I do believe China's going to find a way to get those beans bought, you know, as long as they can do it reasonably. But bottom line for me, this balance sheet on beans is probably going to loosen up on down the road. At least that would be my bet.
Hey, thank you much. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, Todd. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's Matt Bennett. He is with AgMarket.net. Up next is one of those stories about farmers understanding far more than you might think. They need to be a mathematician, an engineer, a banker, a financial analyst. They have to understand commodity trade, biology, and chemistry. On that note, weed resistance to soil-applied herbicides, well, it's forcing a reevaluation of management strategies this season in the field. University of Illinois weed scientists have been screening resistance to group 15 chemistries. Those aren't working as long during the season as they once did. And Aaron Hager detailed this resistance during the annual AllDag Outlook Conference in March, suggesting metribuzin remains a viable option to control water hemp. Here's a portion of his presentation.
So just to give you a brief update, I think in a couple of areas of the weed science community that I think are going to play pretty important here in 2026. If you remember about 3 or 4 years ago, we confirmed that we have what we call group 15 resistance in water hemp. Now, if you're not familiar with group 15 products, that would be things like Dual 2 Magnum, Zidua, Outlook, Harness, these products. And we actually made that confirmation only on one or two populations that we had actually identified in Illinois several years ago. So when we left off that work, the big question that was always hanging out in front of us was, okay, how common is this? Because we really had no idea. We had it in two populations, but we really couldn't assume it was only going to be in two populations. And so I brought on a new student in the fall of 2023, and their project was to try to get a better estimate on how common this would be. Now, for those of you who use those products primarily in corn, they're in a lot of the premixes that you're using in corn, those active ingredients. If anybody on the soybean year is doing this concept of layered residuals, or trying to add a residual herbicide in with your post-application, that layered residual will be a group 15. And so how you see this resistance to soil-applied herbicides manifest is that your length of residual control gets less and less. Okay, so I'll give you a classic example. This year will mark 30 years since I've done my first plot work with water hemp. So 30 years ago, back in 1996, we had a trial in Bond County, Illinois. We had an experimental compound called F6285 that became into the market as Authority. And Authority actually, at that time, was probably the best soil-applied herbicide that we had ever looked at for water hemp control in soybean. It was the closest thing that we ever saw to giving you season-long control of water hemp, which anymore, that's kind of an absurd thing to even mention. So at the rates that we were looking at 30 years ago in Bond County on a sensitive population, we were still greater than 90% control at 6 weeks after planting. Now, you fast forward to about 3 years ago, we did the exact same trial at the exact same rates with the exact same product in Champaign County, okay, a little different soil type. But the biggest difference was the Champaign County population was resistant to the PPO chemistry, which is what Authority is. So at the same rates that 30 years ago was giving us greater than 90% control at 6 weeks on this resistant population, we would have had to post that field at 3 weeks. So that's how this is going to be manifest. So what we did in the fall of 2023, we raced around the state. We made collections of water hemp from soybean fields predominantly. But what we wanted to do is try to bring these into the greenhouse where we could actually do what we called a discriminating dose. We can't do the dose response experiments because those are very time consuming. They're very large experiments. But that's what we need to confirm resistance. So what we decided to do is we took all the collections, which, by the way, I think we had like 127 collections. We hit collections in 84 of Illinois' 102 counties. So we had pretty good distribution around the state. So we decided to do what we called a discriminating dose. So we selected a rate of dual 2 magnum that gave us about 45% survival of a known group 15 resistant population. Now, why do you think we picked 45%? Anybody want to guess? It's very scientific. We had to pick something, okay? We picked 45% because we didn't want a rate that was going to be so high that we might be excluding populations that had a lower level of resistance, but we didn't want it too low that we would advance more populations that really shouldn't be advanced. All right, so what did we find? Out of the 127 collections, we were able to germinate and use 104. So out of the 104 collections that we had going into this, I really had no preconceived notion what the frequency of this would be. So how many of these populations, if they had 45% or greater survival, we would have advanced them to this dose response and actually calculated a resistance ratio. So out of the 104, about 42% would be advanced to do a dose response. I was really hopeful that number might be like closer to 10% or maybe 15% at the most, but it was about 42%. Now, again, we're not confirming, we're not trying to claim that we have resistance in 42% of those populations, but if we would actually have had the time and the resources to do those dose responses, we probably could have come up with that ratio. Now, the reason we bring this to your attention, of course, that's very important chemistry for us in both corn and beans. But we have to recognize the fact that if this is as common as what these numbers are suggesting is, we really can't assume that we're going to get these weeks-long residual control like we used to. Okay, it's just not going to work for us. Now, on the good side of things, several years ago, we asked the question, why don't we use more Metribuzin in Illinois? Anybody remember the old Syncor back in the 70s and 80s? Syncor 75 BF, okay? Because Metribuzin actually exploits one of the very few weaknesses in the resistance profile of water hemp. Okay? So what does that mean? Well, we actually use two types of triazine herbicides in Illinois and Indiana. We use what's called symmetrical and we use asymmetrical. So a symmetrical triazine, all that means is that the nitrogen atoms in the phenyl ring of that molecule are symmetrically distributed around that ring. Very common example of a symmetrical triazine is atrazine. Okay, simazine or princep is the other one. When an asymmetrical triazine, the only thing that means is that those nitrogen atoms now are not symmetrically distributed around the ring. And the most common example that we have of a non-symmetrical or asymmetrical triazine is Metribuzin. All right, so where are we going with this? We have two types of triazines. We have two types of resistance mechanisms to triazines. One is very simply a target site mutation. the target site has changed and the herbicide can't bind there. The significance of target site resistance to triazines is when you have target site resistance, symmetrical triazines do not work, nor do asymmetricals. So you lose the effectiveness of both. The weakness, that one weakness that I just mentioned a few seconds ago, is the fact that most of our triazine resistance in our Midwestern populations is not target site based. It's metabolic. So in other words, they're resistant to it because they rapidly break that down. What is the significance of that? When you have metabolic triazine resistance, your asymmetricals do not work. Your symmetricals do. So atrazine's not going to work, but metribuzin still can. So years ago, we did a little rate titration work. We had, it wasn't Syncor because that product no longer exists. We actually used Tricor, which is a 75DF product from UPL. So we said, all right, what rate should we look at? What rate of a 75DF are most people comfortable with? That 5 ounce or 5 1/3 ounce is fairly common. So we really didn't want to guess. What we ended up doing is we put 16 rates of Tricor. We started at 1 ounce of product and went to 16 ounces in 1 ounce increments. Okay. So essentially what we found is that once you hit 10 ounces of that 75DF, your control really did not improve. So there really was not much of a need to go greater than 10 ounces of a 75DF. What was that control level like at 10 ounces? At 10 ounces of Tricor on a population of water hemp in Champaign County that was resistant to herbicides from 6 different classes, okay, that's our worst case scenario that we found so far. 10 ounces of metribuzin 75DF at 6 weeks after planting, we were 92% control. It looks a lot like what Authority used to look like. So again, our summary is the PPO resistance is really limiting the residual activity that we can get from many of our soil applied products in soybean. Quite honestly, folks, I think we're missing something with metribuzin. I think that still can give us an option. Is it going to last the entire season? No. Is it going to control every other species in the field? Hell, metribuzin never did before. Why do we think it will now? Never killed a velvet leaf or cockleburr that I know of. But if amaranthus is your target species, that might be something that you want to think about. You know, a lot of conversation I've heard this morning, I'm not an economist by any stretch of the imagination, wife even pays all the bills at home. But metribuzin is probably going to be a little bit cheaper option than a lot of these other products in the marketplace right now, and it can work.
That was Aaron Hager, Extension Weed Scientist at the University of Illinois. His remarks were recorded during the annual WillAg.org All Day Ag Outlook Conference held in March. Let's turn our attention to the growing regions across the planet. Mike Tenor is here. He is the CEO president at T-Storm Weather. That's in Naperville, Illinois, and at tstorm.net online. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us. Let's jump right into this. The hard red winter wheat in Kansas, parts of Colorado, Oklahoma, maybe a little Texas, has had a difficult winter because it's been so very dry, actually much longer than that. It does need rain still. Can you give me an idea whether there is a reprieve coming? I think there is.
Well, there is for some of the crop, and the big question regards how much of the crop is going to see these big rains. There's several systems that will move eastward over the next 5 to 10 days, and more than likely even beyond then. And because of that, there's always going to be this low threat for a big rain event for hard red winter wheat in the plains. But Todd, one of these absolutely has to verify, and here's why. If you look at the proportion of U.S. production that had less than a quarter of its normal rainfall over the last 30 days, for hard red winter wheat, that stands at 56% today. If we go back at our entire record all the way to 2012, there's only one day in April that ever had higher coverage than that, and that was on April 22nd of 2022. And that's in all of those Aprils. So this is one of the driest situations we've had there in more than 14 years. And we've been flirting with this severe dryness for a while. I mean, this story started back in the middle of March, and it's still ongoing now. So we need some of these ranges to verify. We think that about 30% of the U.S. hardbread winter wheat crop will see some pretty decent rains. There's a cold front that will move through over the next 24 hours with some storms there. There's another system that moves through tomorrow night and Saturday with some more storms. And then after that, there's several more systems that will move on by starting as early as Monday and Tuesday. So there's certainly many threats for rain. But if you dig into the details, this is where we're a little bit concerned. The reason we're going to see these nice rains in the eastern areas is because they're in a fairly low elevation, similar to the Corn Belt. Their elevation is maybe 500 to 1,000 feet, and it's pretty easy for nice muggy air to hug the ground when you're that low. As you move into the western plains, which is where all this dryness exists, their elevation is much higher. It's anywhere from 2 to 5,000 feet, maybe even higher than that. And in order to get some big humidities out there to make for some big rains, you need to have a slow feed of southerly winds that'll transfer muggy air northward. And if you don't get that, then what happens is these systems move across. You get a few storms here and there, but nothing ever turns into a big event. And that's why we don't think that all this crop is going to benefit from rain.
You mentioned that the eastern areas were going to get more rain. Did you mean the eastern part of the Corn Belt, states east of Kansas? And if so, how much?
Well, we're referring to central and eastern areas of Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. That's where that 30% of hard red winter wheat will get some nice rains. As you move further east from there, Todd, there's a lot of rain on the way for the Corn Belt. Now, it's a bit uncertain exactly how each of these systems will move by, but there's many systems out there, and it's going to be very warm over the next 5 to 10 days, too. You put warm air in front of a bunch of systems, and that's how you get thunderstorms, and we'll see a lot of those over the next 1 to 2 weeks. So we think that corn and soybean planting will eventually turn wet as we move into the middle of the month, and certainly once we get about 10 days out. And it's not only just because we're looking for 1 to 2, maybe even 3 to 4 inches of rain. It's because we think that's going to happen over a pretty wide area. And when you get a big volume of water developing like that in the central U.S., that's how you can develop moist conditions pretty quickly. The only thing we would say that's more on the positive side is that a lot of this rain is going to stay to the north of the Mid-South and the far southern Corn Belt until we get into some point next week. And that's where planting typically takes place first and is taking place right now. So it's not a story of everybody having this problem. On the flip side, though, Todd, the Mid-South's in a drought, too. That's the same area that's being affected by some of that dryness that we're talking about in the plains. And so while they don't want rain for planting, they do need rain to improve soil moisture.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot, Todd. I'll see you. Talk to you soon.
Mike Tenores with T-Storm Weather at tstorm.net online. You may hear him again in the Closing Market Report podcast if you'd like. You can just search that out in your favorite podcast applications or look for it at willag.org. That's willag.org. I'm Extensions. Todd Gleason, you have a good afternoon.